Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We hear a lot about the Hawaii Crime Stoppers program to help police solve major crimes. But have you heard about animal crime stoppers? We talked to Keone Vaughn, formerly with the Hawaiian Humane Society.
A new smartphone app not only directs you to events in Hawaii's arts community, it illustrates the creative process behind them.
And some companies are opting to directly pay for employee health costs rather than provide traditional health insurance. Hawaii is a world leader in this area. We'll hear why.
Storyteller Jeff Gere supplements his favorite stories with live dance and percussion in his new performance of The Porter's Tale from the Arabian Nights.
It's Monday, March 5th. The conversation starts now. But next, the news. Animal cruelty. Animal advocates say research shows there's a link between childhood cases involving violence against animals and violence against humans. Keone Vaughn is on the board of Animal Crime Stoppers and is here to tell us more about the organization. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I've heard a lot about Honolulu Crime Stoppers, you know, dealing with that program over the years, but I hadn't really heard much about Animal Crime Stoppers. Tell me about that.
Sure. So Honolulu Crime Stoppers began Animal Crime Stoppers in early of 2001 and formed a partnership with the Hawaiian Humane Society. And its goal at the time was to provide tips to prevent animal cruelty. And what we noticed throughout the years, many years, is that the level was really for felony animal cruelty only. And there's not a lot of felony animal cruelty going on right now, or has been, so we've decided to lower that threshold to include all types of animal cruelty. And so that's what we're here today to let the public know.
So you just did that this year?
Yeah, we just did that, implemented this year. So Crime Stoppers will pay up to $1,000 in reward for tips leading up to the arrest of anyone abusing animals.
And so is the number different from the regular Crime Stoppers number that folks call?
It's still the same number and it's still the same process. It's 955-8300, or you can do Star Crime on your cell phone.
Okay. And so what types of cases are we talking about? Because we often hear, you know, neglect. We hear issues surrounding like puppy mill organizations, that kind of thing. But what else is out there?
So it can be from the most egregious cases like the puppy mills, or even this dogs left in a car with the windows up and the dog is suffering, or dogs or animals left without any food and water and shelter. So again, we are trying to break down the barriers and really try to protect animals in our community, because we do believe that there is a link between abuse towards animals and abuse towards people.
And you mentioned earlier when we were talking this morning that you came across a case involving a situation where you were called about animal abuse and found something that was happening with kids.
Yeah. So in my early years at the Humane Society, I was assigned to a case and investigated a puppy mill situation where there were dozens and dozens of dogs living in really squalid conditions. It was really horrific. And we even had a hard time coping with the conditions of the animals, but we quickly saw that there was also some child abuse going on. And so that was my actual first interaction with the link between human abuse and animal abuse. So we got the CPS involved. And CPS was able to rescue the kids and prevent them.
Right. So it's really then the help that you can give a community goes much deeper than animals. It can affect the welfare of a family and young children.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's why we really took a hard look as the board of directors and looked at all of our programs and really decided to focus this year on our Animal Crime Stoppers program.
Is it the idea then if you get a call and you can flag these cases or these situations that there can be some kind of intervention so it doesn't escalate to something worse?
Sure. And I think, you know, what we're here to do is break down the barriers from and provide an outlet for the community and the neighbors. You know, if you see something going on that doesn't look right with an animal or any kind of crime, but many people kind of hesitate because they're fear of retaliation. So what Crime Stoppers does is we provide that anonymous way. You call into Crime Stoppers and you can give us a tip. You remain completely anonymous. There's no caller ID. There's no recorded conversations. We take that tip and then we forward it on to the reporting agencies. And they, in turn, will investigate without any kind of retaliation. And if that tip is successful, you can get rewarded up to $1,000.
Okay. And so the idea, though, is if you get the information to, let's say, the police officers, you can either intervene early on or flag a situation where if it becomes a felony case that you have them on the right track.
Absolutely. So we refer the animal-related cases to the Humane Society for follow-up and all the other cases to the police department. And it's really important to know that a lot of people don't realize that we're a completely independent nonprofit run by a board of volunteers, a board of directors that are volunteers. So we are an independent organization separate from the police department, but have a partnership with them, obviously.
And then what about situations where we've seen the hoarding of animals? Because I think looking back at the cases that I've covered personally, there were folks that had an illness and were hoarding animals and loved the animals and felt that they were doing everything to help and protect them, when in reality is that the animals were in such poor shape that they were really hurting them.
Right. So that's where I've personally investigated dozens of hoarding situations. And it's a very sad situation for not only the animals, but the individual themselves, because as you mentioned, it is an illness. So there's a lot of follow-up going on that needs to happen to prevent it from reoccurring. And so with the public's tips, we get that first call to be able to intervene as quickly as possible. And if it continues, then we can rely on that tipster to let us know that it's happening again.
Are those some of the hardest cases, the hoarders?
I think, my passion has always been about both animals and people, but specifically last 15 years has been animals, and any animal abuse is hard for me personally. Hoarding cases are probably one of the most difficult to rectify because of the mental illness going on.
Right, and then you do have to, I think, surrender the animals, right? I mean, if they get taken into the Humane Society for care, immediate care, I know the Humane Society sometimes wants to find new homes, permanent homes for them, but there's that whole thing of they've got to relinquish ownership, and sometimes that's hard for people.
Very, very hard to recognize that what they're doing is actually hindering the animal and not helping. So it's a complicated dance, if you will.
What about for large animals? Because we've seen cases where there is neglect with, let's say, horses who are just left out in a pasture and there's not much, you know, food to feed on and maybe no water.
Yeah. So we have had calls in the past when I was at the Humane Society where we had 7 horses that had no water for a very long time. And so those are the kind of situations that we are asking the community to call Crime Stoppers and report those tips so we can immediately outsource those tips to the appropriate agencies and respond quickly and save those animals before it's too late.
Now, Crime Stoppers has a fundraiser coming up next month. Tell us about that.
So we have this will be our 12th annual fundraiser and again, all the monies that are raised go towards paying out the rewards. And our theme this year is to focus on our Animal Crime Stoppers program. So we've titled it Felines, Canines, and Wines. And that's on April 6th at 5:30 p.m. at the Honolulu Country Club. We do have sponsorships available, and our tickets are $100. And we're still looking for silent auction donated items. We have right now about 50 items with a value of over $10,000. So if you have the time and you'd love to support our Animal Crime Stoppers program, we encourage you to come out.
So this is a fundraiser for Honolulu Crime Stoppers in general, but the focus is highlighting the changes with Animal Crime Stoppers.
Correct. So we'll be going over our program and encouraging people to help get the word out. And also we'll be giving people ways to be a partner and helping solve animal abuse in Honolulu.
Okay. And you also mentioned that Crime Stoppers has a student Crime Stopper program, but That's going to be another story, yes, another day.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, thanks so much. Keone Vaughn is with Animal Crime Stoppers. To learn more about the organization and the upcoming fundraiser, visit the Conversations Facebook page.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, taking the arts audience into the life of the artist with the smartphone as the portal. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, with the Oscars still on our minds, we're thinking about a 1932 Hollywood movie about Hawaii that scandalized the nation. It was made in the so-called pre-code area, when movies often pushed the boundaries of what could be shown on screen. In this case, a nude swimming scene with Dolores Del Rio was the cause of the fuss. The real scandal, though, was the movie's collection of island paradise cliches. Joel McRae was a star playing a visiting yachtsman who's saved from a shark attack by Del Rio, who was an island princess. She's the daughter of an island chief, and their romance is stymied by the fact that she's promised to another man. Unbridled passions ensure under tropical skies. The movie was produced by David O. Selznick and directed by King Vidor, with music by Max Steiner, some of Hollywood's A-list talent at the time. Today we're looking for its name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, across the country, hundreds of thousands of rape kits never get tested. New Mexico has a plan to fix that. We'll hear it. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
There's a world of experience behind every work of art, and a new Hawaii-based smartphone app is aimed at taking the local art audience inside the creative process that informs it. The app is called Art World Escape, AWE for short, and creator Paige Donnelly spoke with us about her reasons for building it.
I think living on an island, you talk a lot about real estate and the lack of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's very much true in the art scene here, and there's just a lack of venues both for artists to show their work, to perform, and for artists for their creative process, studios or recording studios. And so what we're trying to do with this idea is find if there's not physical space for artists to present and actually sell their craft, how can they create more experiential space, or carve out space on more of a virtual world to actually earn a living.
This kind of represents an entirely different approach to space, because maybe a generation ago, if you said, I want to be an artist and have a studio, your first concern was finding a space.
Right, right.
A physical space.
Yeah.
And then paying for the same, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think I was... I moved here for a job in the arts, and I think that was sort of the first thing. There's two big surprises. You know, one, Honolulu and I've come to learn the rest of Hawaii has an incredibly vibrant and thriving art scene. But two, there's just zero space.
Yeah.
You know, or I mean, that's an exaggeration, but there's a real lack of galleries and other public arts venues.
And so what an artist basically wants to do in the visual arts certainly is just to be seen, to be shown. And how do you get around the lack of a physical space?
Right, then? So, I mean, that's where we're hoping by creating a virtual platform that provides that space online is actually a way to connect people to artists.
Because now a lot of artists have websites, a photographer or a painter
right,
will
right,
have a website,
exactly.
But you still have to get there.
Yeah, no, exactly. There needs to be that portal. I mean, it's a lot of, at this moment, because of sort of barriers of entry, there's a lot of hand-holding. You kind of have to bring people in and craft, you know, openings to make sort of the art scene more porous to the local community and also to all the visitors to Hawaii.
Porous is an interesting choice of word, and it kind of implies a two-way movement, yeah?
Yeah,
artists getting closer
absolutely.
To the audience, audiences getting closer to them.
I mean, and another special thing about what we're trying to do is actually allow people to come behind the scenes and for artists to share, you know, sometimes what's a very intimate and private, and rightly so, but to share this very mysterious creative process, like what goes into composing, you know, a work, or what goes into really drafting out a painting and whatnot.
So, because a lot of what it makes a work of art interesting is the reason it was done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the narrative behind a piece is, to me, like the only reason why I would ever actually buy a piece of art is because I now understand the narrative and either the joy or the pain that's gone into, you know, the very labor intensive. You know, part of creating.
Well, your emphasis on that creative process and taking the viewer into the creative process is well beyond a listing of galleries or, you know, these are the art galleries, these are the photography studios, whatever, right? So that's what strikes me as different about this app.
Yeah. We're trying to actually connect a user of the app directly to artists. So to, in some ways, cut out the middlemen and allow for that face-to-face time with artists to really gain sort of this, like, insider's and magical look into the art scene, yeah.
Well, you've just launched. How long ago?
We did a soft launch this past weekend, so that was February 16th or 17th.
And it's a free app, and I just put it on my phone with your assistance. And what do you get when you download the app?
Yeah,
what are
so
you
it's,
going
it's
to
a
see?
Free app that's both available on the App Store and Google Play. And when you first open it, you're taken to a page called Discover. And on that page, there's a listing of different experiences that give you these inside looks into the creative process. So artists who will invite you in for a studio visit or perhaps a workshop, some artists that have designed neighborhood walks to talk more about place. And I think an artist's view on place is especially important in what we're trying to showcase on this app. Other artists have designed these impromptu experience or performances that are more interactive in nature. And then there are a few artists that have actually invited you into art making, so to help with an installation or other, you know, painting with murals and whatnot.
What does it take for an artist to be included?
So our artists have, up until this point, it's been an invitation-only process. And so we're working very closely with artists that we feel like are really leading in their fields and to design these experiences. And I think, you know, in some ways it's been actually this two-way invitational process, because it does take, it's a bit of a self-selecting crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, I, you know, can understand how intimidating it is to, like, invite people behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's artists that we've sought out, and then also artists that have sought us out. So it's been we've kind of met in the middle there.
Well, given that it's a business, the question arises, where does the revenue stream?
Yeah, so we, as a platform, just to put things in context, galleries and other physical spaces tend to take, for visual arts, they tend to take anywhere from 40 to 60. I've seen a couple of galleries that have actually even taken 70% take rate on the sellings of works.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, I understand why that exists for physical spaces. It, you know, a lot of that money goes into actually affording, like, a brick and mortar place. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really, really important for the majority of for the majority of payments that are about an artwork to go to an artist. So our platform takes 10% off of
the sale of a work of art, an admission charge.
No, we currently don't sell any works of art, but out of the ticketed experience. Yeah.
So you would the artist would create an experience with a charge to it. You get 10% of that.
Exactly.
Paige Donnelly is the creator of Art World Escape, a free smartphone app that connects local artists with visitors and residents who want to view their work and understand their process. You can download the app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. If you make a serious workers' comp claim, you can expect to get investigated, and insurers will go to surprising lengths using surveillance methods to make sure your claim is valid, or to disprove it. CivilBeat is looking at the way insurance companies spy on injured workers in its series Waiting in Pain, and investigations editor John Hill has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
An insurance company might go to quite a bit of trouble if they think you filed a spurious claim, yeah?
Yeah, they're quite willing to hire investigators to follow you, make sure you're not doing anything that's at odds with your claimed injury. And that could include videotape, just reports from what they've observed. And oftentimes it will go on over the course of a year or so.
Which you would think would cost the insurance company quite a bit of money. Why is it worth it to them?
Well, I think they do find fraud. There are cases where they find pretty outrageous fraud. There was one case I cited that involved a guy who had been a roofer and really was injured, but he was off the job long enough that he raised some suspicions. And it turned out he had started his own roofing company and was going after the business of his old company. So there are actual fraud cases. Critics of the system, though, will say there's a second reason to do this, which is just to sort of add to the adversarial feeling of a lot of the work comp cases and to discourage people from making claims.
Well, if you have an adversarial relationship, having gotten a legitimate injury and find yourself in an adversarial kind of situation, that's sort of turn you against your job, I would think.
Yeah, that could definitely be the case. I mean, a lot of the workers that I spoke to feel, and they were innocent workers, they didn't find any fraud in those cases, and they felt their privacy was violated. They felt that they couldn't go about their normal lives. They were afraid that something they did that was totally legit, even had been recommended by their doctors, would be picked up on film and used against them.
This is this is people who reported being followed when they drive around, vans parked across the street, somebody taking pictures or video of them. Yeah,
Yeah, and in one case, it was a woman who had been assaulted. She was a psychiatric technician at the state hospital. She was assaulted by a patient, and she became very fearful of strangers. And she was actually diagnosed with PTSD. And experts say that in those kinds of cases, this can be particularly disconcerting to the worker. They're already fearful and sort of traumatized, and then they notice that somebody is following them.
Yeah, that would do it. It certainly would do it. It's surprising, though, the lengths to which they will go, because I would wonder if it was actually cost effective. I guess it's more in terms of the psychological effect of that kind of surveillance.
Well, it is the case that the surveillance often occurs in these sort of long running, complicated cases that are expensive to the insurance companies. Hemic, which is the state's largest insurance company, told me that they only will do surveillance in about 2% of the cases where they have reason to believe that there's something going on. And I guess they find that cost effective. Now, I don't know if that's the case industry wide, if it's only 2% of cases. I talked to dozens of injured workers, and many of them had been surveilled. Now, these are with different insurance companies. So it's really unknown how widespread this is.
Just in the empirical evidence that you gathered, what you saw was probably a lot more than 2%.
Yeah. And of course, the workers I was talking to were the workers who had sort of long-running, complicated cases, and mm-hmm. they might be more prone to having this kind of surveillance done on them. But it did seem like it is a fairly accepted and common technique.
Well, it would certainly be a strange sensation to find a van following you down the street, wouldn't it?
Yeah, many of these workers said that they were very disconcerted and confused. And then when they realized that it was not somebody who was stalking them, but it was an investigator, that they felt humiliated that they hadn't been believed, that the insurance company suspected them of fraud.
Well, it's a good story, and thanks very much for pursuing it. Thanks a lot, John.
Well, thank you for having me on.
That was John Hill, investigations editor at Honolulu Civil Beat, with today's reality check.
Parents are often the first ones to know when something just isn't right with their child. But what should they do next? I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Join me today on The Body Show. We'll talk about a new neurodevelopmental center that will bring all the experts together at the same time to help. That's today at 6:30 on The Body Show.
Even for those fortunate to have it, health insurance can still be a significant monthly expense for many families. The same goes for the employers who provide coverage. But what if you no longer had to deal with copays and premiums? That is a reality for workers whose employers use a type of coverage called captive insurance. As it turns out, Hawaii is a worldwide leader in captive insurance. The State Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs has an office to help employers set up these alternative coverage plans. It's headed by Andrew Karata. He talked with our conversation producer, Ryan Finnerty, about how captive insurance works.
A captive insurance company only provides insurance to its parent company or the owner of the company, not to the general public.
So car insurance is something that everybody out there listening is mm-hmm. probably pretty familiar with. Can you use car insurance as an analogy to explain how a captive insurance plan works compared to a more conventional third-party system?
Yeah, I think everybody's familiar with car insurance. But say from a personal aspect, if you were to take the amount of premiums that you pay in a year for your car insurance, and say if you were to think back about the last 5 or 10 years of your history and how much claims you actually paid for your car. For some people, maybe they got into a big accident and the claims that they were reimbursed for actually exceeds the amount of premiums that they put in. But for others, it could be far less. Say if you haven't gotten into an accident in the last 10 years, really all the premiums that you've been paying to your commercial car insurer, you know, has been going to them, but you haven't had to collect any of it. So kind of in that manner, from a risk management standpoint for a large company, they could say a certain type of policy, say for their commercial general liability policy, and they think of, you know, for the last 10 years, we pay this amount to this commercial insurer annually, but over the last 10 years, we have, you know, we do a really good job in controlling these claims. So we really have a lot less claims that come in than the actual premiums that they're paying out. So if we form this captive insurance company, and this captive insurance company writes this policy to us, for the years that we have low claims, all the income stays within the organization.
Because that you would otherwise lose mm-hmm, to
that
a premium.
That you would otherwise be paying to a commercial insurer, right. Yes. The risk behind that as well, though, is that if the claims exceed the premium amount in the commercial sense,
then you're losing money.
Yeah, then you don't have to pay extra. Mm. But if in through the captive insurance program, if your claims exceed your premiums, then you have to put additional money into the captive insurance company.
So it can save you money, but there is some mm-hmm. risk to it mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. And we found that a lot of companies, they really appreciate, or they find their captive insurance companies to be very successful, because talking about cars again, I think naturally as humans, if you purchase a car, you might take better care of it than to say if you're just renting it. Now they know that the claims being paid aren't just going to get reimbursed through a policy that they've already paid for. It's the claims being paid are coming out of...
It's not a fixed expense
mm-hmm,
anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's not okay. A fixed expense anymore.
Okay, so in real world terms, if I own a company and I use a captive insurance scheme, I'm only providing insurance to the employees of my company. We're not in a pool with,
mm-hmm.
with
yes.
many other people.
Yes.
And so what are the benefits of this type of insurance plan? Why use this captive approach versus the more conventional third-party insurance company?
So captive insurance companies are very specialized programs, and a lot of times that is one of the main reasons why a company would form a captive insurance company. Many times these companies, through the commercial market, they might find that a certain policy that they're seeking is too expensive, or it doesn't quite match the specific insurance need they're looking for, or that sometimes they're looking for an insurance policy and a certain type of insurance coverage, and the commercial market doesn't offer that.
Are there certain types of companies or sizes of companies that it makes more sense for them to use a captive plan?
Most of the captive insurance companies are formed by medium to larger corporations or companies, organizations, because really the captive insurance has to function like a normal insurance company would. So for someone to start a captive insurance company, they need to infuse a lot of capital and surplus. It's a larger investment up front.
So the difference being that if I am the owner of a business and I want to provide insurance for my employees, and I outsource it to a third party, they're paying a monthly premium to HMSA or Kaiser Permanente mm-hmm. or whoever. That's not the case under a captive plan.
No, that's not the case. And that's one of the reasons why sometimes companies, when they assess their risk management policies or just their situation that they're in, a captive insurance company would be something that they consider. For example, when you go through the commercial market, the premiums that you're paying, it's not only the premiums that are the estimated losses for your company, but you're also paying the commercial insurer, you know, additional costs and expenses like overhead or maybe the salary, you know, the salaries of
business
the agents.
Expenses.
Business expenses, exactly. Where when you form a captive insurance company, you can reduce a lot of those costs because you're forming this company, but it doesn't have any employees or certain other fees and costs like a third-party commercial insurer would have.
It's almost like a fund within your existing
mm-hmm,
business.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's fees for certain service providers and things of that nature, but it's not the same type of expense.
Most of the money is going directly to the healthcare rather than overhead?
Mm-hmm. Your healthcare, yeah, yes.
Okay.
In this specific example.
Right. Yeah. And here in Hawaii, how prominent are captive insurance plans?
Well, so for a little bit of background on the captive insurance Hawaii, the captive insurance law was first enacted in 1986. So we've been doing captive insurance company here in Hawaii for over 30 years. In 2016, we were ranked third in premiums written in the U.S., and we were ranked fourth in the U.S. for the total number of captive insurance companies licensed in Hawaii, and 11th in the world. And we actually licensed 30 captive insurance companies in 2017.
About how many captive insurance companies are there total within Hawaii?
As of December 31st, 2017, there were 230 licensed captive insurance companies.
So that's pretty significant because mm-hmm. there's only less than five really major third-party health insurance companies that most people have access to here.
Yes, yes. And then captive insurance doesn't only apply to healthcare insurance. There's various types of coverage as well.
So if there are any employers out there listening that are now interested in setting up a captive insurance plan, how can they get in touch with your office and can you help them do that?
The best way to go would be visiting our website because they have a lot of really good information about forming a captive and things of that nature.
Okay, and we'll post all of that information on our website as well.
Yeah,
Andrew, thanks very much for coming in today.
All right, thank you very much.
That was Andrew Carata speaking with our producer, Ryan Finnerty. Andrew is the acting captive insurance administrator for the Hawaii Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs. You can find a link to more information on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha. I'm Dan Leaf, former Deputy Commander at U.S. Pacific Command, a retired Air Force Lieutenant General, and now a security consultant, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. Christopher Phillips joins us on the line with his expertise. Welcome back, Christopher. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be back. For this week, stargazers, keep an eye out for Jupiter and Mars in the late night sky. Jupiter rises around 11:15 p.m. and Mars at around 1:30 a.m. The moon this week will be passing through its last quarter phase, which means a return to dark skies by the weekend.
And we have a name that we have not heard from in a little while on Stargazer. You have news relating to the Hubble Space Telescope.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about new telescopes recently, but it's the old Hubble that has been observing a distant star system known as WASP-3-9. The team using Hubble has been able to model the atmosphere of a giant planet in orbit around that star. In fact, this is one of the most complete studies of an exoplanet's atmosphere that has ever been performed.
And Hubble, that's a tiny telescope compared to these big ones on Earth. I'm assuming the way they did this was by being out in space, they just get a much better vantage point.
You get a lot better image quality out in space, and they also use that good old tool of the astronomer, spectroscopy, to get the data. The team watched as the planet orbited the star and observed the difference in the star's spectra as the planet passed by. This enabled them to determine what the planet's atmosphere was made of.
What's some of the data reveal?
Well, it turns out that this planet is very similar to our own Saturn. However, the chemicals in its atmosphere are very different, and it implies that the planet perhaps formed very far out in space and then migrated into a closer orbit.
Migrated like caribou or butterflies migrate? How does that work?
It sounds weird when you mention migration and planets, but when solar systems are forming, things can be very chaotic and planets can move around quite a bit. The reason we don't see this in our own solar system is because it's middle-aged, and so things have settled down quite a lot.
Well, thankfully, we wouldn't want things moving around all that much, would we? Well, another good report, and appreciate the heads up. It's Christopher Phillips, and thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, celebrating its 30th anniversary. Architects for the Culinary Institute of the Pacific,
committed to environmentally sustainable architecture and interior design. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's backyard quiz, we got to thinking about a movie that was made in the days before the production code placed severe limits on just how sexy a movie could be. Pre-code movies can be surprisingly risque, and this one took full advantage of its beautiful star, Dolores Del Rio. Her nude swimming scene was a favorite of actor-director Orson Welles, who later married her. She plays an island princess whose star-crossed love affair with Joel McRae, a visiting yachtsman, just isn't meant to be. She's been promised to another, but McRae crashes the wedding by running through a ring of fire and making off with the bride. The lovers run away together, but Del Rio's character has a responsibility to her people that draws her back to the island. The volcano is about to erupt, and only she can save them, appeasing the gods by throwing herself into the crater. Love in this story does not conquer all. The movie was Bird of Paradise, made in 1932.
And congratulations to Richard Vlasic of Pearl City. He got it right. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, providing contemporary content weekly to Hawaii students designed to encourage reading and discussion as preparation for college and career. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
This story's been around for more than 700 years. Scheherazade was betrothed to the king, who had a bad habit of executing his brides the morning after the wedding. She delayed her own execution for 1,001 nights by telling stories without giving away the ending, relying on the king's curiosity about what he would hear the next night to keep herself alive. Storyteller Jeff Geer's next show interweaves stories from those 1,001 nights, better known as the Arabian Nights, with live dance and percussion. He's here to tell us about The Porter's Tale. Hi, Jeff.
Peace be with you all, and to all of you, hello.
And the story you tell this morning will delay your execution for yet another day. We can
that
only
day
hope.
Comes to all. But let us tell a tale.
It's a wonderful premise, though, the idea that you keep yourself going by leaving cliffhangers at the end of every day.
I think it's a metaphor for performing.
I think it is.
You're
too.
Invited into the hall, you're treated well, and your life hangs in the balance. Yep.
Well, it takes a certain fortitude to pursue a life that way, but that's the life you've been pursuing, right?
Yes. But, you know, you're only as good as the show that you're doing, and this one is a full throttle roller coaster. I mean, it's huge. It's getting the genie in the bottle. It's massively, at one point, I mean, the plot just changes like somebody who had crafted it for hundreds of years in tea houses or in sultans or on the caravan routes.
Exactly.
When it was written down 800 years ago, it had already been worked over. And it works that way. When I used to, 15 years ago, when the Iraq War was building and then crested and shock and all of that,
right.
Willow Chang and I and two musicians crafted it. It was in Indigo Restaurant for 18 months of Saturdays, on and off, couldn't get in, sold out shows 3 weeks ahead. And basically, we began to live in the Arabian Nights as the headlines were telling us a lot about Persia.
Whenever I hear about the early days of storytelling, it sounds to me like the birth of performance art.
Yeah.
In which it starts out with just a good story, words, and then the art of the storyteller in sort of working the drama of the story, right? Following its peaks and valleys, that's what you do.
Well, yeah, but this material particularly is exceptional. It surprises me, and I know what's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy's about to be beheaded in the middle of the desert, and he says, "Oh, I pray Allah, forgive the man whose hand is raised to kill me. Oh, I cannot kill a man who can pray in this way. I forgive you." Lets him go. It's like, what? The whole plot? And poetry and philosophical issues, free will against predestination, on and on and on. The oppression of fortune. And it's just, it's a full-on and sexy and funny jokes that are 800 years old still get a laugh.
That's a weighty phrase, the oppression of fortune. I got to get my mind around
baby.
That.
Baby, it's full of those. I've got a notebook full of these crisp little twists of phrases translated from Arabic into English, and I've gone through like – I have a whole bookshelf full of Arabian Nights texts to pull little bits out of this one and that one. You know, this is like – you know, I'm an old man, and I'm like trying to live up to representing – this culture and these stories in a way that I feel proud of, that will infect the listener with as much awe as I have. This is, I mean, massive, epic storytelling literature. It's the pulp fiction of early Islam before everything got codified and there was the do's and the don'ts when they were exploding out of, you know, the sands of Arabia with this zeal for learning and sharing the new word and the vision with the sword, but also intellectually.
In the days when people were traveling up and down the Silk Road,
yes,
those who were not traveling up and down the Silk Road lived for the stories they heard from those who had, right?
You know, it's the easiest thing for people to share stories and then take them with them.
Yeah.
When you're carrying a caravan and you've got a camel and you're going to be on it for 6 months, you know, there's a campfire over there. Let's pull up. We're not enemies. Let's sit and share food and stories. And if you've got some liquor, good. Shadow puppets out of skins and stories that you can tell and move and speak from the tongue and infect the mind find their way back to the tongue. And it goes on and on and on and on.
And even finding yourself in an environment that might not be that congenial, you could, as did Scheherazade, keep yourself alive by saying, wait, I got a great story to tell you.
Right, right. Well, and yeah. The djinn is about, gives the, I will give you a choice. Would you like to become a monkey, a dog, an asp, or a bird? I would not like to be any of these. What? I would like to be you to treat me as did the envier and the envied man. What? Is that a story? Of course it is. Let me tell it to you. And we're off. When the story ends, we're back to it. Forgive any hope of escaping my necromancy. It's like...
And then the genie, what, takes off?
Yeah, makes it turns him into an ape. And then his story goes on. I mean, it's just like, what? In the middle of it, you know, the door opens and there's a whole story that unfolds. And then it comes back to where it started. And you go, wow.
Now I'm starting to understand your Pulp Fiction analogy.
Yeah.
Stories that proceed out of other stories, but not necessarily related.
If you
sort
think
of
about
crazy
it,
tangents.
You who are listening now will go to lunch. There'll be four people at the table. And each of them will take a turn and tell a story of what they did last night or the Academy Awards or whatever happened. If you said, now we're going to go to Persia, and we're going to say that each one is going to tell a story to save their head from the woman who has been wronged and has a black guy with a sword at your neck, I will exchange your life for the story you tell me. Now, how did you lose your left eye? Are you hooked? That's the genius of the anonymous people of the sands. I'm bringing these stories to life with Willow Chang, the best belly dancer in town, and Baba Tunji Heath, good foot, big drummer, as they say in musical terms, he's got big ears.
And a lot of the performance is going to be improvised or sort of feeling the moment, right?
Well, you can't
Tunji
avoid that with a live performance.
To...
Yeah, oh, that's totally, yeah, because we're all really busy, and it's like...
Yeah.
If they weren't smart and fast learners, we couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So it's got that fun click. But me, my side, because I'm basically the engine, I'm rehearsing every day. I time out the sections because I don't want it to drag.
Yeah.
And I've got, you know, 3 weeks of story to fit into 2 hours. So I'm methodical. I'm vicious on myself to, like, man, I'm going to take you on a ride. If you come in this door, you are going to have something happen, I can promise. And that's my obligation to presenting another culture and this epic tale of the Arabian Nights.
I'm inclined to believe you, Jeff. Sound effects. I wish you could see how this guy is dressed. But we'll put pictures up on our website of the visual impact, complete with the curly-toed shoes.
The impact is on your mind and the imagination, which I am here to provoke.
There he goes. Storyteller Jeff Geer, abetted by dancer and theater artist Willow Chang and percussionist Babatunji Heath, will perform The Porter's Tale the next two Saturdays, March 10th at 7 p.m. in HBO's Paul and Vailu Theater, and March 17th at 7 at the Arts at Mark's Garage.
The state. Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at some events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And today we have word that that we can mingle with local authors in a monthly event that's tomorrow in Kona.
Yes, the Words and Wine event takes place at Kona Stories Bookstore. You can meet and greet this month's featured authors, Holly Rudin Brashi, Nancy Flood, and Kate Lindman. Complimentary poo-poo and wine will be served at the event, which starts at 6 p.m. at Kona Stories. It's located in the Keauho Shopping Center.
And a new exhibit begins tomorrow at Honolulu Hale. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's from the Association of Honolulu Artists, the AHA. It was formed way back in 1926, and this is their 48th annual Aloha Show. The exhibit features all original 2D and 3D pieces in all media, and it runs from tomorrow through March 22nd at Honolulu Hale.
And Kilauea Volcano is celebrating an anniversary this month.
That's right. March 19th marks the 10th anniversary of Kilauea's summit eruption, and Hawaiian Volcano Observatory geologist Matt Patrick will recount the first decade of this ongoing eruption, including an overview of what scientists have learned from it. This talk is happening tomorrow at 7 p.m. in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium.
All right. Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek joins the conversation to take a look at the events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Go back a million years or more, and you might just find the origins of human speech. Next time on The World, a scientist looks to the hunters and explorers, whom we call Homo erectus.
All their activities show a need for language. With the evidence for organization and planning and culture, erectus would not have had that big a hurdle to get to language.
Finding our first words on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
We know it's the year of the dog, but think you've been seeing lots of dogs in stores and restaurants these days? Well, tomorrow we tackle the issue of service animals and comfort animals. It's difficult determining the fake ones from the real ones, as these four-legged creatures seem to be becoming more common in public spaces these days.
And we always like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line, leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about our guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.